Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of The Holtz Effect. I'm your host, Thomas Holtz, and today we interview a very special guest. Well, because I graduated high school, woo! And summer began, and I'm packing up for a trip for Hilton Head now. I'll actually be going back for the second time. I went 2 years ago, had a blast, I'm looking forward to it, especially because I'm going back to the Jazz Corner. Now, the Jazz Corner, for those who don't know, was founded in 1999 by Bob Masteller and his wife, Lois Masteller. It's been called one of the top 100 jazz rooms in the world by Downbeat Magazine, and it has hosted such esteemed guests as Freddie Cole, the George Shearing Quintet, Chuck Lebb, the Vache Brothers, a ton of famous people. And I actually got to perform on stage there. I was having dinner with my family because I just in my first year at our school's jazz ensemble. It was a way to celebrate. And they called me up on stage, and I did an impromptu performance. It was not planned. I was surprised. I got signatures from the band I played with in a little book. It was great. And I'm going back, I'm getting all hyped, and I'm thinking, you know, I could do a great podcast on jazz. Hopefully. So I decided to invite someone who's a little more well-versed in it than I am, at least in terms of knowledge and repertoire, my good friend Jack McCarthy. He and I were both in the jazz ensemble together at Fairfield Ludlow High School. We both just graduated. So I decided, since he's been wanting to get on the podcast, I'd have him on. And this is our conversation. I interviewed him a little bit about his musical interests, his history with jazz, and retrospective on the influence of jazz and music, the controversies of sampling, and etc. I hope you enjoy. We certainly did.
Time for an interview.
So thanks again, Jack, for coming.
Yeah, of course.
So Jack will be attending Rhodes College in the fall, and he'll be studying music, and I don't know if you're doing another minor or anything.
I'm not sure. I'm trying to find something to kind of tie into music, maybe like economics, international studies would be cool.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, so how would you go about doing that? Like, are you thinking of the music industry or?
Well, I'm not really sure yet. I think music as a major for me is more of a kind of a we'll see where it takes me kind of thing. But then I want to pair it with something that would either function on its own or function with music. Because I think especially in Memphis where Rhodes is, there's a lot of record labels.
Yeah.
So music and economics would actually function very well together.
Definitely. I'd see that.
Yeah.
So anyway, I invited you over here to talk about jazz, and I was just wondering if you were starting. I actually see you wear a shirt to match. So, ladies and gentlemen, for background, Jack and I were both in our high school jazz ensemble together. Fantastic trombonist right here. And he, in his free time, he also does music production. So, a little bit of lo-fi, hip-hop, a little bit of EDM, using Logic Pro 10, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so in his free time, he'll just be on his laptop. And I brought him here to talk about what he loves and basically his perspective in the music industry. So, there you go, music and economics. Be really good insight. And Jack, I was just wondering, so I want to start off maybe with talking about your Birdland experience. I remember near the end of the year, you were saying how your jazz teacher invited you over to do a show at Birdland.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
So I take lessons with this guy, David DeJesus. He lives in Norwalk. And I was in the Western Region Jazz Ensemble, and he was actually the conductor of that. So he kind of said to everyone, if you ever want to come play with the band down at Birdland, let me know. So I figured I would start taking lessons with him, and then a few weeks went by, and I asked him, is it cool if I come play with you guys? He said, absolutely. And so, yeah, I showed up. It was actually very funny because I got there, but I couldn't use the actual band entrance because I wasn't really part of the band. So I got there before the doors opened, but there were people in line already. So all they saw was this guy in black carrying a trombone outside. It was really funny. But yeah, no, I got in. I got to play a song with them, which was crazy because these guys are all, like, top-of-the-line musicians. And it was cool that, like, I didn't stand out as, like, too inferior to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, what was it like? What did it feel like?
It was, to be honest, I got up there, I was terrified. Because the guy I was sitting next to, his name is Ron Wilkins. He's a killer player. He does a lot of Broadway shows. He was just touring in Japan, actually.
Wow.
So he's like the real deal. and he was kind of giving me a hard time just because I was like the young kid sitting in.
Yeah.
But basically, as soon as the song started, I just kind of like transported into the music. Like that kind of goes for whenever I play. I'm just kind of not there mentally. I'm just kind of entirely focused on the music and not about anything else. So yeah, it was really an incredible experience. I got to do a solo, which was
nice.
Which was a little bit scary, but it was a lot of fun. Great experience. Yeah.
And so I actually went to Birdland myself last summer for something called Jim Caruso's Cast Party. It's like an open mic night, but you have to like sign ahead of time. I just remember I was a little bit too, like, they had Billy Stritch, who's in a ton of Grammy winning songs, and then I forget her name at the moment, it's embarrassing, but the lead role who did Eliza in Hamilton was there. And
oh,
she
wow.
did she performed the heck out of God Bless the Child.
Wow.
Incredible singer.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a little bit humbling. I was just so what if, I don't know, I just kind of like, they're like, wow, I'm sharing the stage with like who knows how many other people, like Charlie Parker, etc. But then there are all these people surrounding you. I was just wondering too, if when, well, obviously there's the people you're playing with, but were there anyone else? Like, did you meet anyone there?
I had my parents there with me, which was kind of more scary than anything else, because it's always, I always want to impress them. And people weren't physically there, but I looked up on the walls and saw all the pictures of like Tito Puente and all these crazy jazz guys who had been on that stage before. And it was just crazy to think that I was, like you said, like I was in the same stages that these people had been on before me. And it was just nuts to think about that.
Yeah. And I got to ask though, so for all the Birdland experience, I'm wondering how long you've been into jazz and like, what do you gravitate to? What do you like about jazz? And what exactly is like the history of jazz that sticks out to you?
That's a very good question. Well, so I started playing trombone in the fifth grade. And then after that, I did the middle school jazz band for like 2 years just because I enjoyed playing. But I didn't really know all that much about jazz music. And then I remember my grandfather, he lives in Westport. He's really big into jazz music. And he probably has the biggest jazz CD collection I've ever seen. I kind of walked in on him. He's very hard of hearing. So when he listens to jazz music, you can hear it throughout the entire house. So I was probably 12 or 13 that I walked in there and I heard him listening to, I think it was Take Five by Brubeck. And that was, there was just something about it. There's just something about like a swing feel that just like, it just kind of resonates within me. So then I got to high school, did every jazz thing I could there, and I just kind of became infatuated with it as I got more and more exposed to it. Started playing with better people, started playing better songs, and now it's just something I love to do. And also, I think what fascinates me a lot about it is that because, like, when you think of, like, great jazz musicians, you think about Coltrane, Miles Davis, all guys who are way before our time.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting to see how, because, like, there are a lot of people in music today who have jazz influences, and they're finding ways to modernize it, which is really a cool thing.
Depends on who, too, though. Like, sometimes you say, oh, I'm influenced by jazz, and there's nothing like it. Like, for example, my choir teacher would always say, oh, this is a very jazzy chord, but it wasn't jazz at all.
Yeah.
So it really depends, like, who's got the soul. Like, you look at Jacob Collier, he's really doing his thing.
Exactly.
But then, besides him, there's not much else.
There's this guy, his name's Leo P. He plays Barry sax. He's, like, crazy clothes, crazy hair.
Ah.
And he played in a brass band, but now he started this genre called brass house, which is essentially dance music, but it's a trumpet, a Barry sax, and a guy on percussion. But like, he's jazz trained from Manhattan School of Music, so a lot of his melodies and a lot of the songs have a very strong jazz feel to it while not really being jazz music.
That's cool. I say also, I have a question, like, there's this, have you heard of a guy named Haywire?
No? Yes, I have.
Yeah. Incredible guy. So
he signed with Monster Cat, I think.
He used to be. I think he's gone on, I don't know what his label is doing now. But yeah, so for all the audience listening, for those who don't know Haywire, he's toured with Zedd, Grammatic, Matt Zoe, a ton of artists. He's very accomplished, classically trained. For those who don't know, he's classical, jazz, and actually metal. He was in a metal band before doing his Haywire project. Quite a lot of influences there.
Yeah, no, there's also this guy, Anomaly. Have you heard of Anomaly?
Yes and no.
I believe he's French, and he's like, he does this pretty cool like electronic stuff, but like he's a jazz guy, but he's just found a way to incorporate it with something that's more accessible to an untrained listener, which is like a really cool thing to see.
I suppose too, why one of the reasons we're here today, also discuss, kind of the change of music. I like to bring people on and ask them, like, how do they think the industry's changed throughout years and how genres have progressed. So we can start wherever you want. It doesn't have to be jazz. But how do you think music industry's evolved?
Well, I think the music industry, one way is that it's a lot more accessible because you'll have these, like, cult hits. Like, you look at XXXTentacion. Like, he started out on SoundCloud from, like, the absolute bottom, and now he's kind of, like, a cultural, like, phenomenon.
Yeah.
And, like all these guys I listen to on SoundCloud, like, it's very easy to get into it, and all of the tools are so easily accessible now that it's all done electronically.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, there's a cost involved in it, but yeah. I think anybody who wants to be good at doing music and, like, producing... It's all, any resource you could possibly want is basically at your fingertips.
Almost.
Almost.
For a proper fee.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just got to do the hunt. I was like, hunt for the free plugins, whatever I can get
hands
on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just remember, like, looking around, all this you see here. I just looking around for, like, ever and ever. It takes months and months to look at it over. They always say music more accessible, but there's so much choice, so much diversity in what you can use. Even this right now, right? Like, okay, gotta get this because it has the built-in DAW. This has this thing I can use, but then I had an extra charge, like I couldn't use the VST. Yeah. It's such a mess.
That's why, like for me, like if I'm producing something, like I mean, I don't take it all that seriously. I'm not trying to like become a producer and all that. So like I'll basically work with what I got at my fingertips.
Yeah.
Like the first like 5-6 months, I was just using the keyboard on the actual laptop. Like, I didn't have a keyboard, so I would use, like, the musical typing on the laptop.
I miss having that. I used to do, like, an FL Studio demo when I was first learning. It had the keyboard. This PreDeSonus Studio 1 doesn't have that. I'm like, whenever there's, like, something I want to plunk a note, I'm just like, where'd you go?
Yeah. No, FL Studio seems like a very interesting program, and it's something I've always wanted to try, but I have a Mac, so I don't have that chance. But
Logic's much better, anyway. I guess now I'd have to ask you, where'd you start with music production?
Yeah, so I started out, I always liked using GarageBand just because I didn't really know what I was doing. But then I kind of, like, one day, I think I was sick. So I decided to take the day and try and teach myself how to put together a little song. So, like, I put some simple chords down. I recorded, like, a snap and a few, like, background, like, humming vocals and stuff. Put it on SoundCloud, titled it Sick Day. Because it's hard to title something if you don't have words to it. That's one thing that's very interesting for me because, like, all of my quote-unquote songs are just ways for me to practice improvisation.
Yeah.
That's basically all it is. Like, because, like, if you look at anything I make, like, you build up, like, I have chords, and then I'll have, like, a solo break on the chords, and then that's about it. But it's just ways to, it's a lot of fun, honestly.
It is very fun.
Yeah.
I guess so. That's the story on Sick Day. I was wondering, maybe you could tell me a little of the others. I was trying to like prepare myself mentally, just like listening to your SoundCloud profile. And there are quite a lot of diverse names. And some, like, I'm looking at like your track Funk, for example.
Yep.
It's not very funky, but it has this element where it really has those roots. Like, is there do you need to choose names for the song? Is there like a lot of meaning for it? It's just like, oh, the day I was sick.
I don't think about it much. Some of them are pretty nonsensical. Like, it's just like, I just don't want to put it up as, like, untitled. Yeah. So, like, if it's, like the one I titled Funk, I sampled from they're called the Menahan Street Band, and they're like, a pretty funk-based group. So I, like, sampled a little bit of one of their songs. So they're a funk group, so I titled it Funk. And I don't know. I think it's, that's something that it's hard to title something that there aren't words to, because I'm not a very good singer. And there's no way in hell I'm gonna rap. So, I don't put too much thought into it.
I once read this guy Puppet, also a Monster Cat artist. He once said that he actually comes to the name before he even starts the song. Like, he has the word vagrant in his head and just starts building off of that. Do you ever have a process like that where the name comes first?
No, but that's actually a brilliant idea. I never really thought about that, but that's actually a brilliant idea, because sometimes like my mood will influence where I go in a certain direction. Like if I'm having like a not so great day, I'll go for like a more down tempo minor key, and then if I'm feeling particularly good that day, I'll go from like a more upbeat kind of thing. It's like it's just like whatever I'm feeling, you know.
Yeah. And you mentioned sampling, so another thing I want to touch on for this episode, while around the music industry, is the art of sampling. Like recently, I just actually got back. Have you heard of the Avalanches?
I have not.
So this group from Australia, in 1999, they came out with this album called Since I Left You. It started a concept album, moved away from it, but the whole thing is based around samples. There's like, I don't know, like 3,000, no, this is definitely an underestimate, like 3,000 samples.
Wow.
And it's only like, what, 12 to 24 tracks? I don't remember the number right now.
Jeez.
But it was so critically acclaimed, it was like, this is incredible. And then they didn't release another album until 2016.
Yeah.
So you're like, whoa, where's it going? And I was kind of thinking, it requires a lot of clearance to get all those samples. And there's a whole article about that on the Red Bull Music Academy website. And I was thinking, too, like, there's so many artists now who use sampling. We think of hip-hop. When you think of art, like, I mentioned Grammatic. He's made a whole living off of just, like, ripping YouTube videos off and, like, cutting them up.
Yeah.
But there's, like, such an art. It's so engrossed. Now, when copyright comes to the fact picture, it's like, well, this is my livelihood. So do you ever find that social? What is your stance on that?
Well, I think it's, for me, I don't think much about it because I'm not making money off it.
Yeah.
So I can, I can just take whatever I want without any fear of, like, repercussions because, like, no one's really listening to my stuff. It's just more for me, for fun. But I think if an artist is sampled, I think they would have a legitimate gripe against someone who's making royalties off of their work. If it's sampled in a way that is kind of, indistinguishable, that's different, I guess. I mean, I think it's a very muddy topic.
Yeah.
Because, like, there's a lot of different things to take into account.
Yeah.
It's kind of like YouTube, like, with the whole fair use thing.
Yeah.
It's, like, it's all very muddy and murky, and there's a lot of sides to it.
Yeah, I started, too, like, reading the band Justice, this duo.
Okay.
So their first album, actually all their albums are sample-based. But they're like, okay, we're going to get screwed if we have to clear all these samples. Let's take the tiniest bit of each sample we can and just remix it. And so it's basically thousands upon thousands of samples, like, they're like microseconds worth. And it's all super glitchy to all to avoid the copyright.
Yeah.
And then there are artists like Pretty Lights or Grammatics where they use very extended samples. And they, like, people, like, for example, Pretty Lights did a song called Finally Moving, which has the, oh, sometimes, that Etta James sample.
Yeah.
That Avicii used in Levels and then Flo Rida and Got a Good Feeling.
Yeah.
So there's such a binary, like you said, it's so murky, muddy. There's those who are trying to hide it and those who don't care.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just think there's this guy on YouTube where it's just a compilation of, like, samples and where the samples came from.
Yeah.
And I think it's a lot in, like, classic hip hop. A lot of classic hip hop has some, like, really cool, like, jazz piano stuff. And I think sometimes it's very interesting because, like, I'll watch those videos and I'll hear a sample and I'll immediately think I know what song that's from.
Yeah, it's a cool thing.
Yeah.
Where did I find that? Oh, yeah. That was it. Actually, so you're doing Straight Up and Fly Right, right?
Yeah.
So the other day, I was listening to a Grammatic song, and he'd put in the sample. I was like, oh, this is it. It's
a cool feeling.
But I think a part of it, too, when you sample a song, you bring it back into public consciousness. It, like, revives it.
In a sense, I think that's an argument that could be made, but I think in some cases, it's not necessarily.
Yeah. I know, but, like, going back to the whole jazz greats.
Yeah.
They're, like, so well-known, so well-respected, but their consumption is declining. There's
a paradox. For sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, like, it's like a teenager is not going to sit down and listen to Giant Steps or like most teenagers. Like, it's not something that's like, it's like very hard to like enjoy it.
Yeah.
In a sense, like, if you're not really into jazz music, it's kind of harder to, like, sit down and listen to it. And it's not as because, like, I think rap is, like, kind of a, it's more accessible genre, I guess.
Yeah. But it's all, like, changing so much. Like, rap used to be mostly about the sampling. And you have all these old songs, whatever you could find on a dusty used shelf.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's completely completely new, completely, like, synthesized. There's no sampling, and there's not really that tradition carrying back.
Yeah.
There's an evolution. Like, there's even a debate. Is even rap anymore? It really is. It's still trap music, but it's changed so much.
Well, I think that's not necessarily true, because I think, like, there are some producers, like, if you look at Kanye, his production is, like, top-notch, and he'll use these really, really obscure samples. Like there was that one song, it was Lift Yourself, where, like, he was, like, poopity-scoop and all that. It was, like, he was, like, nonsense words, but basically, he sampled this, like, really, really old, like, song from a black funk group. and it was just like the coolest instrumental. And I think a song with a good sample to me is better than a song with just like an 808 and some hi-hats in there.
Yeah. Actually, I've never really listened to Kanye myself. Is he actually a producer? I thought he had guest people doing the track instead.
I think it depends, but Kanye is a very, very good producer. He produced an album by Pusha T called Daytona.
Oh, yeah.
And that album is very, very well produced. He produced stuff with Kid Cudi. And he's just so talented. It's really crazy.
Yeah. I guess we're talking about that now. So I just think he's such, well, obviously, controversial figure. Always has been, especially now. But one of the funniest things to me is that going through the yearbook we just got, Kanye's the most quoted person. There's such irony to that.
I think Kanye knows exactly what he's doing.
Yeah.
Like, I think he knows what to say to get the public to look at him.
Yeah.
Like the whole thing with Trump was like before an album.
Yeah.
And he drew so much attention to himself.
Oh, really? I don't know. Oh, yeah. Wasn't Life of Pablo delayed, though? Was that really intentional?
I mean, I don't know. I think he's very good at bringing... He brings enough attention to himself without drawing too much ire from the public.
Yeah.
Like, he's obviously very polarizing, but I think he knows exactly what he's doing.
Yeah. What'd you say is your favorite Kanye song? No.
Favorite Kanye song? I'd say Heartless off 808s and Heartbreak. That's just like, that's just more of a nostalgia thing for me when I was like, oh God, I must've been like 11 or 12 when that came out. Something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's like, that's a really good album.
Yeah. There's a remix of that by a guy named Slips and Slurs is his foreign name. He's Slippy now, but he had it, the whole cover. It's actually really well done. He's got, I think someone named, I forgot who the vocalist is, but, it's really good. It's really in the few scrapes I had, but then I was listening to Otis the other day.
Otis, yeah.
Yeah, that's actually very good.
Yeah, he sampled Otis Redding. That's that's a good song. That's him and Jay-Z.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it like even speaking of Jay-Z,
first billionaire black rapper.
Yeah.
Actually, no, first billionaire rapper. Doesn't matter what race it is.
Yeah, he's like a lot of his instrumentals have pretty good samples on them. He sampled Nina Simone on the song about OJ's the Life of OJ, I think it was called. Like, I didn't listen to that album. But.
And he had Ennio Morricone. I think I'm saying that wrong. The opening to The Good, Bad, and the Ugly. And what's that song? H-O-V-A. What is that song? It's the opening to, like, it's like a part two or something. Blueprint? What is it called?
The Blueprint?
They played it before every football game. You kind of know what I'm talking about.
I don't know, man.
I don't know. I'll find it later. I'll add in post. So... Really, why right here is really just to ask a little bit about your style, music process, your thought process.
Sure.
Because what I want to do with part of the Holt Effect is get a project, get lesser known artists out there to really talk about their style and their way of writing.
Yeah.
Because you've already given a lot of insight, but I'm really wondering what's the root? Like, what genres you're growing up with? Like, what are your like core influences? And like, how do you that translate into your workflow?
I wouldn't say like there's this guy on SoundCloud. His name is Quickly, and I think he's one of the most talented producers in the world today.
Okay,
I'm biased because I love him, but he did an ad with Red Bull Music, and he's our age, and he's like crazy.
Really?
But it's like he kind of has this like lo-fi electronic jazz kind of fusion thing going, and that's kind of what I like to base it around. But I would say in the music that I make, I wouldn't say that there are any like super like strong influences. I just kind of like, when I sit down to make a song or instrumental or whatever you want to call it, I don't have a set idea in mind. I just kind of play around on my keyboard, and then I find an idea I like and I build off that. And then the next thing I know, it's like 2 a.m. and I'm still working on it. But, yeah. But in terms of musical like influences in general, a lot of jazz guys like Coltrane, guys like J.J. Johnson. I love Brubeck. I love. There's so many.
There are so many.
There's so many guys that I like, and then for I love rock music as well. I was like the first full album I ever listened to was American Idiot by Green Day. I was like 8 or 9, and that was like when I kind of started to appreciate music a little bit more serious. And then rap, I do love rap music. I think Kendrick Lamar I have all of Kendrick's albums like saved on Spotify. Like, he's kind of my go-to guy because he's just a lot of his instrumentals are like extremely jazz influenced. Like on To Pimp a Butterfly, he has Thundercat playing bass on that album, and I think just lyrically he's just so far above a lot of other people.
Yeah. So when you're writing a song, where do you start from there? You just mentioned all the influence, but like when you're sitting down at your laptop, like what's the first thing you do?
The first thing I do, well, I open Logic. That's step one. Yeah. And then basically I start out with I go into the synthesizer patches.
Yeah.
And then I'll mess around with like chords first and try and get some like chords ideas down. I like to do chords before melody and then do the melody over the chords and see what works. And even in my songs, there's not really a melody, I'd say. I'd say it's more just random improvisation here and there. But yeah, so I'll find either a synth lead or a synth pad that has a nice sound. And then I'll usually throw a few plugins on there, mess with a few of like the, I'll basically just turn random knobs until I get something I like.
Yes.
And then I'll sit down, I'll record it. And then after that, I'll find things that kind of complement that well. And then after all that, I throw on the drums.
Really? I always think of drums first. I don't know what
that's. That kind of makes more sense, but it's just not the way I work. I like to have the drums accompany the melody and the chords. So I like to have all that laid out first before I tackle that.
I always think of drums because actually the first album I'd say I listened to in full was Zedd's Clarity.
Yeah.
When the titular single is out, I just impulse bought the whole thing. I don't regret it. It was awesome.
Yeah.
But I noticed the like melodic use of the drums. How he's using an intro instrument. I always thought that way since I started listening to a lot of electro house after that.
Yeah.
And then Damascus of Dinosaur Jr. He's the guitarist, but he started as a drummer. He says he always thinks and writes as a drummer. The first thing he said is the drum beat. And most of the time when they're doing the song, it's not actually the drummer Murph who's doing lines. It's him. Like, for the longest time, the first albums, it was actually Maskus playing all the drums. Murphy was just doing the live shows.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of the beauty of it. I think music is something that you can come from many different angles, and there's not really a right way to do it. Like, and it's just constantly evolving, and it's really a beautiful thing to see. Just, like, the constant, this genre is more popular, and this one's kind of fading out, but then it comes back all of a sudden for some reason. And, yeah, I think, because music is just something that's universally, like, you're not going to know anyone who doesn't listen to music.
Yeah.
Like, obviously some people are into it more than others.
Yeah.
But I think music is something that's just so universal.
Yeah. Actually, it reminds me of a story. So I was just in my college orientation, and we had a little, like, social activity. Like, basically, it was you say something about yourself, and you, like, link arms to someone who shares that. And so I went up, and I was like, okay, so I'm here, and I like music. And absolutely no one moved. And like one girl just went up to like she felt pity. But then later on I find out one of the people in the group, he's like really into music. And I'm like, why don't you go step up? I feel like sometimes people are like embarrassed or don't know, but there's always that one song.
Because I mean I think music is kind of something that if you don't like really love it, then you're not gonna be like, oh yeah, I'm really big into music.
Yeah.
Something you kinda listen to on the side. But I think everyone has some musical interests. Some people are more vocal about that than others. Yeah. Like, that's why, like when I played basketball, I kind of was like, I would have to miss practice for, like, a band rehearsal. Yeah. And I'd be like, oh, God, I have to tell them that I'm going to a band rehearsal to miss practice.
Yeah.
I think there's – I wouldn't say it's a stigma, but I'd say it's, like, a little bit, like, quote-unquote, like, nerdy.
Yeah.
Like the band kids, the choir kids.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, I felt the same way. Like, so I've been doing track all 4 years of high school. I never had a problem. But then I just did the a cappella group this year. And they were always in conflict practice because, like, the warm-up was right when a cappella practice ended.
Yeah.
So I'd always, like, coach, I have to leave. Like, it was, like, almost every – and because it was concert season, it was, like, every day of the week. It was awful.
Yeah.
He was, like, trying to give me looks whenever I had to tell him.
Yeah, like, that. I was
kind of – email on email.
I was kind of, like, why I quit basketball. Because, like, I really did enjoy it. But I definitely wasn't good enough to play in college, like not even close. But music is something that I think I'm pretty good at, so I figured I would just chase it and just go as far as it would take me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still on that path right now.
So any words of wisdom for our audience? They're going to wrap up right now.
I think that if you find something that you think you enjoy, just chase it And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But that could be your thing. Like, music is my thing. But going into high school, I thought I was going to try to play basketball for a Division III school. And it's just crazy looking now because music is my life. So if you have a passion, just chase it.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, man. I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you again. Congrats on Rhodes. We hope you do great things.
Good talking to you. All right.
So that was the interview. I certainly had a great time talking to Jack. I thank him again for coming on the show. And once again, I wish him well at Rhodes College. But now it's time for Artists of the Week. So last time we did a music episode, I talked about the band Guster, American alternative rock band, graduate from Tufts. Today we're going to take a shift to an entirely different continent and talk about Fela Kuti. Now, Fela was born in Abeokuta in Nigeria to a very impoverished life. He was one of many children, and he suffered racism at the hands of the British. He was a first-hand victim of colonialism, and he went on to protest against it. Growing up, he was exposed to jazz from the Americas and the readings of Malcolm X and became a revolutionary figure. And with Bob Marley, he's one of those international artists who really crossed over in the mainstream and became a symbol of black culture. He was an incredible force, and he pioneered what is known as Afrobeat with his several bands, Kula Lobitos, Africa 70, Egypt 80, etc. He is one of the most important African figures in history, not just for his music, but for his stances. He was such almost a larger-than-life guy that he was so down-to-earth and humble, but about African pride and about the nationalism of being African, that this is their land, this is their nation, and they can't have that taken away from the white man. And there's a lot of that in his music. You listen to Power Show or Pangsa Pangsa. A lot of those songs are basically ridiculing the white man, especially his song Zombie. Zombie no go unless you tell them to go, zombie. The zombies are the British soldiers who are basically being ordered around, not thinking for themselves. No brain, no job, no sense. Dordo, dordo, dordo. Left, right, left. They just follow orders, directions. He was not afraid, and he was just such a stand-up guy about it. And he was such an accomplished musician. He was a keyboardist, a trumpet player. He was a saxophonist and a singer on top of that. And he really just absorbed traditional African music and jazz and made it beyond those two forms. He made it something new. To a point where he didn't even consider the music Afrobeat anymore. He just called it African music because it evolved beyond that. He was really pushing boundaries, and there are a lot of people who cite him as a major influence, like Brian Eno, the great producer. He got a record in the 70s, and it blew his mind. He keeps saying, basically, for the next 40 years, they kept forcing people to listen to this music because it was the music of the future. And he actually showed it to Talking Heads in the recording Remain in Light. And when you listen to Once in a Lifetime, the polyrhythms of that song are influenced by Fela's music. He also listens to Radiohead. Tom York is a big Fela Kuti fan. And you can actually see in photos from the sessions for In Rainbows, something called Fela Kuti Thing. That was a draft for a song that may or may not have come to be. No one knows the fate of that song, if it changed. But Fela is just one of those guys. And actually, Jay-Z went on to do a musical about Fela called Fela. And it was off-Broadway, got a lot of acclaim. It was actually around the time that Fela's albums were being remastered and reissued. So it was a promo event, and it was really critically acclaimed musical. Some people are like, it's not entirely representative of his life, but it was very well-received. And to understand why he has such an impact, you really just have to understand his music. It's so complex. Such incredibly fast syncopated rhythms. While laid back at the same time, it's danceable, it's complex. Fela intended to be listening music, but you can really get up on the floor and move to it. He himself would have a bunch of his wives up on stage, yes, wives. Bunch of his wives on stage with him, dancing. He used to be swaying with the music, having a great time. And it was just, it's something very admirable to watch, because he really just feels the music. He's enjoying it. That's great to see. And you don't see that a lot nowadays. It often feels very manufactured or forced. Like, okay, I'm on that grind again. But this guy had his own music club in the middle of this compound, which he actually renamed the Calcutta Republic, like, just to spite the white men. It's incredible. He would not stand the oppression. And he turned it into his own little paradise. He raised everyone up with him. His mother was the first Nigerian woman to drive a car. There's a free health clinic. It was incredible. And it actually marks one of the worst moments in Nigerian history, in Fela's history. You see, that song, Zombie, was part of a whole album making fun of the Nigerian police. and the British dudes were furious. Adding insult to injury, the song's a hit in Africa. And so the soldiers wanted revenge. On February 18th, 1977, in the middle of the night, about 1,000 armed men came onto the Republic, and they burned it to the ground. Women were raped, men's testicles were beaten with rifle butts, fella's mother was thrown out of a second-story window, which landed her in an 8-week coma before she died from the same injury. The recording studio fella used was burned, the free medical clinic was destroyed, everything was set ablaze, and they assaulted any passerby who would escape to tell the truth about the attack. Fortunately, a few pictures were taken and ended up in the news being exposed, but it was absolute destruction. Fella and his band actually had to relocate. And by the way, his mother was 77 when she was thrown out that window. So there Fella was. All his master tapes destroyed, his recording studio destroyed, his Republic destroyed. Sitting there in Ghana, taking refuge, while everything died down. And there are kids chanting at the police, "Zombie, zombie." The spirit didn't die. I love that story because it just goes to show how Fela's music would not give up. Even after he started writing Pongsa Pongsa, which is a huge, huge denouncement of the police. It's such an incredible piece of music, too. It's an opus, all right? It's a true opus. I really do encourage all of you to listen to him because he's had such a profound cultural influence. Heck, he's even in Childish Gambino's This America video. Gambino is actually dressed like Fela. And it's funny, I was having a discussion with my American Studies class in high school, my junior year. We were actually analyzing the video, and I pointed it out to everyone, and it was crickets. No one had any idea who this guy was. I mean, it was an annotation on Genius for everyone to see. So, I really do think he should be more in the public consciousness, because he's such a profound historical figure, profound musical figure. His music is very hard to describe. It's just so unique, so vibrant. And he's worked with so many famous people, like Ginger Baker of Cream drummed with them for a time. He actually featured on a few Fela albums. Tony Allen was a drummer for Africa 70 for the longest time. He later left over some disagreements, and he went on to become a drummer in his own right. He actually joined the supergroup Rocket Juice and the Moon, which has Damon Albarn from Gorillaz and Blur, and Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers in that group. He's also a member of The Good, The Bad, and The Queen, which also has Damon Albarn in it. And while Fela unfortunately died of AIDS in 1997, he had a ton of children. He has several who are musicians themselves, and they carry on his legacy. Femi Kuti, one of his sons, actually leads Egypt 80, the new incarnation of it. So he's keeping his father's band going, which I love. And the Calicutta Republic actually was rebuilt. There's now a museum to Fela in Calicutta called the Calicutta Museum, which has a bunch of his instruments, photos, history about him. I want to go now. It's in Lagos, Nigeria, where Fela spent a lot of his time, and it just goes to show his impact, that this small little compound turned into a front of liberation, a celebration of African pride, of blackness. In the scope of racial liberation on a historical front, Fela was a very strong driving force, musically and politically. He resisted sonically and vocally against the oppression of the state by the military junta, and he ended up creating something that immortalizes African culture, connects back to the very roots of the tribes. And it's for the people, not for him. He gave to the community because he was representing his community. So, in a way, it's freedom music. And that is the very heart of jazz, which he took to bring about his own new form of African music. It's a beautiful thing. And with that, I'll leave you with a few recommendations. Some great Fela Kuti songs are Water Get No Enemy, Let's Start, Zombie, Pongsa Pongsa, Power Show, Why Black Man Dey Suffer. Yeah, so this was the black president who named his own compound after the prison cell that he was in, who swallowed marijuana and sat in prison until he pooped it out because he would not be caught with it. This is the guy who did everything he could to represent the people, to resist oppression, and to bring power back to the people. And on that note, we close out this edition of The Holtz Effect. I'm Thomas Holtz. Thank you again for listening. And as of March 30th this year, the Jazz Corner is 20 years old, so I congratulate them and look forward to seeing it soon. I'll see you on the next podcast.